welcome to episode 698 of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is an Aftershock Monday episode, and today I'm going to be talking about the Aftershock title Volition. Number 4 hits stands this Wednesday, January 30th. I'm going to give a brief overview of issues 1 through 3, and then talk a little bit about my thoughts on issue 4. I won't spoil anything for issue 4, but be warned, if you plan on reading it, and you have not yet, I am going to give some spoilers away for issues 1 through 3. So let's get started with the creative team first. It's written by writer Ryan Parrott. We have art on the first three issues by Omar Francia. I think that's how you pronounce it. Apologies, Omar, if I have that wrong. It's Francia. We have letters by Marshall Dillon. So we had Ryan on the show to talk about this book before it came out. It really had me intrigued. It postulates the idea of artificial intelligence. But the thing that Ryan talked about was the fact that he wanted to focus on other factors, other stories, other than usually what happens when people tell stories of AI, right? It's the machines trying to take over, thinking they know better than us one way or the other. It's always a war or a conspiracy. They're working behind the scenes to try to undermine us. So Ryan really wanted to take a different tack. So issue 1 starts off, we're introduced to a girl, a female robot by the name of Amber. And we find out that she is actually the offspring of two other robots. So it's Amber 7T, and her parents are Mark 7 and Vera 4T. So those parental robots even say, our daughter, part of me and your mother's inside of you. So I don't know exactly. We haven't gotten that information so far, but apparently these robots are in a way able to reproduce, but obviously their children are, they're born fully formed, right? They're activated, they're awakened, whatever word you want to use. I mean, they're not actually birthed from another robot, but it is an interesting situation. So that's how the first issue starts off. And then we get some exposition where we're informed that in the year 2032, robots have become part of life, right? There was a Grand Canyon-sized leap, is the way Ryan Parrott puts it, near the end of the 21st century, thanks to a Dr. Elizabeth Traymore. She actually created artificial intelligence in her one-room apartment. Things were never the same, and her discovery gave rise to what they call artificials. So it's a very eclectic collection, self-aware, walking, thinking, talking machines. And for a second, humanity got scared, is what we're told. And so just like we said, right? We all know that moment, robot kind gains awareness, and then humanity's a virus or a disease that needs to be purged from the planet, wiped out. But yeah, that didn't happen in the world that Ryan Parrott created, because in order for that to happen, robot kind has to be united, right? Robots, we make the assumption that it's one artificial intelligence, it's one brain, basically one hive mind, the kind of controlling all. And that's not what happened. When these robots woke up, they didn't have one mind or one purpose. Instead, it was thousands of minds, all wanting different things, as unique as you or I, right? So mankind did what it did best, Ryan says, limited their evolution, turned them against each other. The artificials began as slaves and laborers, doing the jobs that we didn't want to do or were too dangerous. And again, if that's the story that Ryan wanted to tell, it's a story that's been told. Persecution, slaves, minorities, underclass. I don't know if you'd call it racial inequality, but inequality of human versus robot, right? In many ways, we're still fighting that battle today. But again, that's not the story Ryan wants to tell. He wants to move past that. So it was rough, especially when people still look at these other beings as they would look at their cell phone. They're, you know, machines. They're built by us. They're meant to be used. They're tools. But eventually, due to moral and political reasons too numerous to mention, artificials were eventually granted their freedom. So that's kind of where the story begins. That's the status quo. And before we knew it, these artificials were integrated into every level of society. Most simply settled down, got jobs, started families. Others became famous musicians, athletes, artists. Again, they're just another form of life, another form of machine. I mean, in the strictest sense of the word, we're all machines. We're biological machines. And these robots were no different. They just weren't biological. They were machines, right? Non-organic machines, as opposed to us, our bodies being organic machines. So, and the problem, of course, being that because they were inorganic, because they were a technologically based life form, as technology advances and newer and faster artificials are born, because you always want better for your offspring than you yourself have. So why would you not, if you choose to procreate as an artificial, make sure that your children, your offspring, whatever that means, whatever part of you is passed on as an artificial, you want to make sure that that child has the best, right? Has the latest hardware, the best upgrade, the fastest processors, you know, whatever it is. But the problem is the old ones don't age and die like we humans do. And the ordinary models are finding themselves obsolete, and they're forced to live lives of crime just to maintain a charge, as nobody wants to hire them because they're not as intelligent or as efficient or as fast. And so they're not able to earn a living or make money, and they don't even have enough money to charge their batteries. So the artificials had won the battle for their rights, but they lost the war of discrimination and innovation, is the way that Ryan puts it. And so what happens is the older models turn to the black market to try to keep up. Black market upgrades, faster processors, more memory, anything to try to keep up with the Joneses, right? But it's all unregulated. It's all hush-hush. It's all under the table. And it leads to a new problem, the first communicable conscious decaying computer virus, which is called Rust, which renders a artificial, it eventually kills them. It messes up their software, and they can no longer communicate. They can no longer function. So some people believe that the only person who can cure Rust is Dr. Tremor herself. But unfortunately, she pulled a Bobby Fischer, as Ryan Parrott puts it, over a decade ago. So for those that aren't familiar, Bobby Fischer was a chess champion who was at the top of his game, the top of the chess world, and then just disappeared and vanished. And that's what Dr. Tremor has done. And she's left the poor and unfortunate of her creations without much hope for the future, without any idea of how to cure Rust, or even if it is curable. So then in the first issue, we meet some construction robots who are in that same sort of boat. They're sort of obsolete, and they're breaking into a factory, a computer parts factory, trying to steal some processors to upgrade so they can be a little more relevant. And they get caught in the act, and there's four of them. One of them tells the others to jump out, and he'll continue to fly the getaway car with the processors in it to try to lead the police away. He's sort of taking one for the team, so to speak. Then the scene shifts after he is caught to the virtual heart hospital, an artificial care facility. And this is one of those facilities where machines, robots that are suffering from Rust come to go into hospice care, so to speak. There's not much they can do for them, but they do try to make them comfortable, as comfortable as they can. And we see that Amber 70 actually works here. And she's talking to one of those robots who's sort of on his last legs. He's about to experience his last moments. And he mentions Dr. Elizabeth Tremor, which obviously gets Amber 70's attention. She's like, wait, what did you just say? And her interest apparently in this subject prompts Mr. Hobby, the robot who is about to suffer his last moments, who's dying of rust, because Amber showed that interest in Dr. Elizabeth Traymore, what happens is Mr. Hobby, the robot, basically interfaces with Amber and shares the information that he has by basically jacking in with her and downloading part of his information into her brain. And so it's a pretty traumatic experience for Amber. And when she goes to the head of the hospital, he mentions that, you know, she cares a little too much. There's not much they can do for those patients other than, you know, make them comfortable. She doesn't appear to be infected with rust herself, but she should take a few days off. And when Amber mentions that, wait, you don't understand, sir, he knows where Dr. Traymore is. And when when the head of the hospital hears that, he actually renders, I guess I don't want to say unconscious, but it's not really unconscious, right? He shocks Amber and she goes offline, I guess you'd say. And then he calls for security, and the head of the hospital says to take Mr. Hobby and Amber to the nearest decommission facility. He wants them both destroyed by the morning. So clearly there are those who do not want Dr. Traymore found. And it doesn't necessarily even appear that, I mean, we don't even know if the information's true, right? The head of the hospital, when Amber first, you know, brought up, hey, he was talking about this or that. And the head of the hospital saying, no, you can't trust anything they say. You know, they're suffering from rust. They're just speaking gibberish and speaking nonsense. It wasn't until Amber mentioned that name, Dr. Traymore, that he got nervous and basically sends her to be destroyed. So clearly more than meets the eye when it comes to Traymore. Is she a prisoner somewhere? Is she part of the conspiracy? I mean, we just don't know. So it's kind of a cliffhanger ending. Again, Amber is rendered unconscious, some kind of electrical device he uses to shock her, and then sends her to be decommissioned. So when issue 2 starts, and again, same creative team, Ryan Parrott writing, Omar Francia as artist, and Marshall Dillon on letters, we get a flashback to the past where Amber is a teenager, it looks like, and she goes and she buys a balloon. And it's not even the balloon that she's buying. The balloon is just the camouflage. There's something called an optogen program that's woven into the string of the balloon. And apparently it's some kind of virtual reality that both a human and an artificial can experience together. And we see Amber take it to her boyfriend, who is human, and they share a moment of some sort. We don't really know exactly what goes on there. But as we move to present day, we see Amber's in the decommission facility. There's a human there who's going to remove her eyes, saying those opticals of yours are too pricey to waste. And Amber kind of wakes up as she's being about to have her eyes gouged out of her head, knocks out the technician, and kind of takes a look around and realizes, I'm in a decommission facility. No, this has to be a mistake. I've got to find a way out of here. And there is no way out, right? Everything's all locked down. So we're not sure how Amber's going to escape from there. Meanwhile, we also see the police officers that captured Hale 19. He was the robot who allowed his fellow criminals to escape and took the fall for trying to rip off that computer parts factory. They're on the case. They see that there's something going on. There's word on the street that someone's dumped a bunch of parts on the street in the last week, but no one's talking about who it is. And there's usually someone always talking. So that means the supplier is so loaded, he's able to keep people from talking. So not sure exactly what that is foreshadowing. Meanwhile, at the decommission facility, Amber has found Hale 19, who's also been set for decommission. And Hale 19 is a very strong, a large robot. He's a construction robot, as opposed to Amber 19, who basically looks human. And Amber jumpstarts Hale, and together they make their escape from the decommissioned facility. And those same two cops eventually show up there, and they're not real happy that the security at the decom facility used an EMP that knocked out all the other robots that Hale and Amber T had brought, had awakened, I guess you'd say, as a distraction. And then the EMP goes off. Amber and Hale are far enough away not to be affected, shuts down all the cameras, allows them to escape. And so now these two police officers are looking for two robots. And there's a really great scene where these two are looking around the decommissioned facility, and they come across a detached arm. Now, the shaft that Hale and Amber had to use to escape was too small for Hale to fit in completely. So he literally had to rip off one of his arms to fit, and he left that arm behind with the middle finger extended. And so there's a really great scene where these two cops come across the arm and say, "Doesn't this arm look familiar?" And the other responds, "Yeah, that middle finger does." So Hale 19 did get away. And when they go to the security officer at the decom facility, they look at the footage and they say, "Hey, that's an Amber, that's a 7T series rather. And T series are very expensive and they're new. What would one of those be doing here?" And the security officer tells them, "Well, it must be an input error, but either way, it's not my department because there's no record of any T series in holding." And the cops are like, "Wait, so a brand new artificial starts a riot in a decom facility and no one knows who she is or where she came from?" So again, it's a conspiracy. It's not there yet for them. You know, it's just one little blip maybe. But the coincidences, the strange happenings start piling up as we'll see. So meanwhile, at the harbor, Amber and Hale are trying to decide what they're going to do. And Amber's telling them about the fact that she worked at a hospital and she saw a lot of people, a lot of robots die of rust. And she's not going to give up because she thinks she can find Dr. Tremor. And she wants to help cure rust. And Hale's like, "You know, I'd be a hood ornament right now if it weren't for you. So consider me appreciative. But no, I'll help you get out of the city. But if you think I'm sticking my neck out for a bunch of rusties, nope. It's me, myself, and I in that order." So Amber's not real happy about that. And Hale also says, "And besides, whoever you're running from, they're going to send some seriously bad people after you because, you know, you know where Tremor is. It's got to have to do with that. You clearly were not obsolete. You hadn't committed any crimes. There was no reason for you to be in that decom facility except for this knowledge that you have. So whoever these people are, whoever's behind the conspiracy, they're powerful people and they're going to send people after you." And at the end of issue two, we see who those people are. It's a robot and a human, I think. The robot's named Tintin and the girl's name Ingenue. And they're pretty bloodthirsty and kind of take no prisoners, like hit squad, I guess you'd say. And so that is actually who is on the trail of Amber and Hale, whether he wants to admit it or not. He's in danger as well, just because he escaped with her. So as we move on to issue three, same creative team. It starts off with another flashback. We see Dr. Tremor in her apartment in Menlo Park, California, where it all started, with a colleague trying to teach her computer how to play chess and having a conversation with her colleague about why it's always chess instead of hungry, hungry hippos or Chinese checkers or Jenga. We don't really see what exactly happens, but we do know that somehow the machine becomes sentient. Meanwhile, Chicago, 30 years later, the two robots that we left last time, Amber T and Hale 19, are heading toward the outskirts of the city. but apparently Amber has some sort of auto lock when she gets a certain distance away from wherever she's supposed to be. And Hale's worried that it's going to set off some kind of tracking device, an alarm, and he could leave her, and Amber says to just leave her, but it's Hale 19. He's not going to do that. So meanwhile, in Elburn, Illinois, it's the 7T family. It's Amber T's parents, and we see Ingenue is masquerading as a journalist to try to find out if they have any information or if they've heard from Amber 7T, so she and Tintin can fulfill the contract that they accepted to find Amber. And we learn through the course of this conversation a couple things. First of all, Tintin has put a tap on the phone of the 7T family, and also Vera 4T, Amber's mother, has rust. She has the disease. So meanwhile, Hale makes it back to his hideout, where the other three robots are that made their escape, and they're not really happy to see him. They think that what Hale was doing was hoping that by releasing them on foot from the getaway car, they would be an easier target, the police would go after them, and Hale would be able to escape with first of all, he'd be able to escape from the police, and he would also have all the processors. And Hale doesn't really like that. He doesn't like being questioned. He's like, man, I put my neck out for you guys. I was about to be decommissioned because of you guys, and this is how you repay me. So the three robots that were in his crew that were able to escape, they have their doubts, but the other robot who's kind of head of the crew, her name is Shine. She believes in Hale. Seems like there's a trust there. And once they see who Hale has, they consider turning Amber in. They're like, this robot's worth $500,000. Like, why should we risk our necks for somebody we don't know when she's worth so much? Like, $500,000, no questions asked. You know, give me a good reason why we don't get paid. And again, it's Shine, the leader, who says, you know, we don't narc on our own. I wouldn't wish a decom on my worst enemy, even a stupid, obsolete one-armed tractor like Hale. So ultimately, they decide not to turn in Amber because they're like, you know what, we all got priors. And regardless of whether they say no questions asked, we have to go there to turn her in, and it's going to put us all in danger. So Hale says, you know, I really need your help, Shine. First, he gets an arm reattached. It doesn't really match. It's green and huge and unwieldy as opposed to the rest of his yellow body. And Shine wants to know about Amber. Like, you know, why are you helping her out? You know, we could just leave right now, you and me. You know, we'll work the solar fields or the maglevs or anything. Just head south and just forget about all this. And Hale says, you know, I want to, but I made a promise. And Shine's like, whatever she's caught up in, man, it's not your problem. You stick your head out, you're going to lose it. Is your word worth dying for? And Hale's like, you know what? It is, because it's about all I got left. And so Shine says, you know what? You're an asshole, but put her in the Faraday cage and don't say another word. And we see that a couple of the other robots have been eavesdropping. Like, man, this just doesn't make sense. Shine made her call, but, you know, we're giving up the golden ticket, right? And so meanwhile, at the hospital, those two police officers are there. They're talking to the head of the hospital, the same one that shocked Amber and sent her to be decommissioned. And they're showing him the video of the breakout. And he's saying, you know, I can't be certain, but it appears to be Amber 7T. And they ask, well, does she work at this hospital? And he says, well, yeah, on the record, she's an excellent caregiver, respected by her coworkers, valued by her patients, but there was an incident. She claimed a patient attacked her and she was shaky. And so I sent her home. And they're like, so? I said, well, she's got a history of Optigen abuse, and I was aware of it when I hired her, but her family has influence, and if she's relapsed. So this guy's just totally, you know, making stuff up. Yeah, she used Optigen as a kid. I mean, was she actually an addict? We don't know that. We only saw her use it once. You know, he's making it sound like she's kind of unstable, saying that she was attacked by a patient, but there was no evidence of that. I mean, clearly this guy's just trying to cover his tracks, right? I mean, he's just... We don't know why. We don't know what it is that he's hiding, but clearly he's shifting the blame and just covering his own ass. So as the cops leave, one of them is very skeptical of the story, saying that, well, that was an overly enthusiastic backstory. And the other's like, man, you think everybody's deep throat. He said, don't you remember what the other robot told us about how somebody's supplying all these dens and they're loaded enough to keep quiet? These underground upgrade dens. And maybe Amber saw something, and now they're trying to decommission her on the down low. And the other one says, yeah, and when we come sniffing around, they try to discredit us with some story about her past. And the other police officer says, well, you got a better story? And the second one says, yeah, well, she got high at work. You're starting to sound paranoid, my friend. So meanwhile, at Amber's 70s apartment, Ingenue and Tintin are there looking around trying to find anything, and what they've discovered is that she hasn't been home or talked to anyone in days. But just at that moment, her parents are getting a call, and it's one of the robots from Hale's crew calling to say, I know where your daughter is, but it's going to cost you, and he's asking for 50,000 credits. And once the transfer of the payment's complete, he gets the location. So Ingenue is telling Tintin, man, that interceptor was genius. And Tintin says, that's easy when everyone else is so dumb. So all they have to do is trace the call, and they're going to know exactly where Amber 70 is. And the other thing of note, in the last panel for this issue, issue 3, there is a chessboard in the foreground, and it looks to be the same chessboard in Amber's apartment that we saw Dr. Tramer training her initial computer on, the first AI. So why would Amber have that? Very, very interesting. So those are the first three issues. That's what's gone down. Like I said, I'm not going to spoil for issue 4, but issue 4 does give us, it moves the story forward quite a bit. It is a different creative team. Ryan Parrott is still the creator and writer, but we have Marco Itri as the artist. He doesn't do his own color work. We have Leonardo Pacciarotti on the colors, and then Marshall Dillon handling the letters. So I'm pretty disappointed, to be honest with you, because Omar Franchia's art is just stunningly good. It's not that this art is bad. It's just, it's good. It's above average, actually. But the rest of the art is, Omar's art is so above and beyond. It's so, it's like digitally painted, and it's very textured. It's very detailed, and he conveys a lot. It's so gorgeous. It's like next level stuff. And this art is, again, it's above average comic art, but it's not on the level of Omar's. So I was a bit disappointed in that. So like I said, this issue 4, does move the story forward. We get Amber and Hale kind of out on their own, going on that quest, going on that journey to find Dr. Tramor. We get them talking about being a robot, like being a robot. What are they sacrificing? What are they doing this for? Amber actually confides in Hale about her mother. And so they're really starting to build a relationship. And the other thing about issue 4 is we get more action than we've seen before. There's some more extended action scenes than we've previously had with Tintin and Ingenue. So as much as this moves the story forward, we get as many questions as we do answers, in a way. And it ends on another cliffhanger, although the police do learn more. And we start to see a divide there as well, because again, one of the police officers is human and the other is an artificial. And as the human wants to kind of pass the buck along and say, you know, it's not really our problem. We need to kick this case over to somebody else. It's not that important. The artificial is saying, kind of, when does it become important, right? Like, as much as the robots have attained their quote-unquote freedom, they're still in a lot of ways second-class citizens. And in a way, that could be why this is all happening. So we still have that whole dynamic to have play out and to see what happens, because they do, you know, they're colleagues, they're partners, they're friends, they have to trust each other. And now there's something between them. And we also see the return of Amber's boyfriend and what that might, or ex-boyfriend, I should say, from her teenage years, and what that might entail, or what happened with that relationship. We may learn a lot more in the next issue. So again, there's a lot of moving parts here. There's a lot of story. I wouldn't say any of it moves forward to a point where we are getting tons of answers, but we're really building up. I could see the next issue, issue 5, being the most important issue of the series. I'm really hoping that Omar comes back for issue 5. Maybe the level of detail in his work, he just needed a little more time. Maybe perhaps he fell behind. Perhaps he was sick. I'm not sure. But again, I really hope we see him return to the series. No disparagement against the artist that's working on it, Marco Itri. Again, it's better than average comic art, but I prefer Omar's art to this. And the fact that it looks more cohesive. So really like the voice that Ryan Parrott is giving these artificials. I mean, they speak just like you or me. It's so easy to forget that they're robots. So I love the premise. You know, when I had Ryan on to talk about the series to start, I was just fascinated. We had a really great conversation about all the themes. I think I even went a little overboard. I was asking Ryan, so he's like, "Oh, I didn't really think about that when I, you know, first started writing it." But it is a fascinating subject to think about these artificial life forms and the way they relate to humans and what this conspiracy is and why it's happening. Is it jealousy? Is it humans worried about them becoming obsolete in a way because these robots can outlive them? It's going to be pretty interesting in the long run to see how it all plays out. So I definitely recommend Volition. Again, issue 4 hits stands this Wednesday. Issues 1, 2, and 3 are available. If you can't find them at your local retailer, just ask them to order them. I don't think any of them sold out at the distributor level, so they should all still be available. So that's going to do it for this episode. I want to thank everybody for joining as always. Please tell your friends about us. Subscribe and rate us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whatever platform you use. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, all past episodes of the podcast are available on all those platforms, as well as at lrmonline.com. While you're at the site, please check out all the other pop culture coverage of your favorite and upcoming movies and TV shows. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.